I want you to think this morning about what qualities you look for in a leader. If you're looking for a new president, if you're looking for somebody at work to be in a leadership position, what do you look for in a leader? Do you want somebody with a lot of ambition? Do you want someone with a dynamic personality? Do you want someone with tall stature and good looks? Do you look for a record of success? Now, these are the typical things that people seem to look for. And as I contemplated this week, I thought of a man a long time ago who had all those qualities. He stood head and shoulders taller than anyone else around, and for some unexplainable reason, people have always thought that is a trait of leadership. You're tall. And he was tall. And he was a good-looking guy. And, you know, people noticed that, and they liked that, and so they thought that was important and a leader, and so they were happy about that. And this guy had the ability to get people excited and even to get them to do what he wanted them to do, which is what we call motivational ability, and he had it. I mean, he was good. And he was ambitious, and so there was never any shortage of wanting them to do. And, you know, if you're not going anywhere, you can't lead, so that's a good trait, right? And he had it. And this guy that came to my mind had some really significant early successes. He had a track record, and people liked that. And so by any textbook definition, this guy was a leader. Maybe the perfect leader, if one has ever been, by the definition in the book anyway. But unfortunately for this man, none of that was enough. He had all of the expected qualities. He had them in abundance, and still, it did not work out well for him. His name is Saul. Old Testament Saul, the first king of Israel. His story is in the Bible. Ultimately, his character was lacking some things that were more important than the qualities that he had, things that were more necessary for good leadership, certainly better than good looks and ambition and stature. And these things that were lacking were so significant that all the other stuff he had could not compensate. In the end, Saul was rejected by God. His kingdom was torn from his hand. He died a tragic death. His three sons died with him the same day, and God gave his kingdom to another, specifically saying he was seeking a man after his own heart. It's not an easy thing to choose a leader. Not in any environment. Particularly, it can be difficult in the church. Those who have succeeded in worldly pursuits may not be qualified at all when it comes to spiritual matters, to leading in God's church. Those who seem to demonstrate personalities given to leadership may not even be qualified to lead in God's church. A man may be selected who meets all of the accepted marks of a leader, and yet, like King Saul, may end in complete disaster as a leader in the church. And a poor choice for a leader in the church can ruin lives, can ruin families, can ruin testimonies. And you've heard the horror stories. Everybody's got a story about somebody in the church, right? Now, the other side of that is a good choice of a godly leader who is really qualified, can do a tremendous amount to build lives and to build families and to build testimonies. But there's a lot at stake, isn't there? Well, this morning I want to speak with you on the establishment of a church leader. And to seek a better understanding of the subject, I want you to look with me at the master himself and the choices that he made in establishing the very first church leaders. The text is Mark chapter 3, verses 7 through 19. Mark Mark chapter 3, verses 7 through 19. Scripture says, Jesus withdrew to the sea with his disciples, and a great multitude from Galilee followed, and also from Judea, and from Jerusalem, and from Idumea, and beyond the Jordan, and the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. A great number of people heard of all that he was doing and came to him. And he told his disciples that a boat should stand ready for him because of the crowd, so that they would not crowd him. For he had healed many, with the result that all who had afflictions pressed around him in order to touch him. Whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they would fall down before him and shout, "You are the Son of God!" And he earnestly warned them not to tell who he was. And he went up on the mountain and summoned those whom he himself wanted, and they came to him. And he appointed 12 so that they would be with him, and that he could send them out to preach and to have authority to cast out the demons. And he appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, and James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, the brother of James. To them he gave the name Barjonas, which means sons of thunder, and Andrew, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Now, this story is about the leaders that Jesus chose to follow him and to learn from him and to become the first leaders of the New Testament church. The choice of these men was incredibly important because a leadership failure in the first generation of leadership would be catastrophic. But these men did not fail, save the one who was appointed to failure, who was chosen because one of his own had to betray him for the scripture to be fulfilled, except for that which Jesus knew and planned. They didn't fail. They were effective. And the church was firmly established as God worked through these leaders. Now, from this text, I want to give you three reminders about selecting leaders in God's church. Three reminders for selecting leadership in God's church. And the first is this: Jesus chooses church leadership. Jesus chooses church leadership. Before we choose someone that we would want to serve in the church, we need to see the marks in his life that Jesus has chosen him to serve. Now, the focal point of this passage that we just read is verses 13 through 15. It says that he went up on the mountain and summoned those whom he himself wanted, and they came to him, and he appointed 12 so that they would be with him and that he could send them out to preach and to have authority to cast out the demons. Obviously, Jesus is selecting leadership in this part of the text. There are disciples all around him. And Mark sets this story up for us so that certain aspects of this choice would be clear. He's telling the story. He's not telling everything that happened. His gospel is shorter than the others, and yet he's telling the salient part so that we'll notice important things about this choice. And the thing that stands out in Mark's account is the incredible popularity that Jesus was experiencing at the time he made this choice. This selection of leaders by Jesus took place in the context of intense popularity. All of Galilee was excited and they were seeking after him, plus all of Judah to the south, and people from Jerusalem who were the city folks, a little different from the rest of Judah, plus people further south than that, plus people across the Jordan, plus the people from the north and the west and the northwest. Everybody is coming after him. The only people in the circle who aren't mentioned are the Samaritans. Everybody else is coming to see what he's doing. There were so many people that even in this open area out by the lake where there's nothing around, there's no doorway to get through, it wasn't quite safe because of the crowd. There's so many people that the crowd is pressing forward. You can't get out of the way. There's nowhere to go. There's a lake there. And everybody's pushing. The press of the crowd was so great that Jesus had to order a boat to be ready all the time so that if he had to, he could get in it and not be trampled by the crowd. Now, the provision of the boat was not because the crowd was going to attack. That's not what it says. It's because the excitement was so great, people wanted to get close to him. And if you're in a large crowd, you know how this works. You're not at the front, but you want to be at the front, and you think you might just squeeze through that quarter of an inch between those two shoulders. And so you start. You work your way in there, and as you do, people are pushed forward, and the people that are in the back are pushing, and the people in the front are surging forward, and they want to get up there anyway because they want to touch him. That's what it says. You know, if I can just touch him, all my problems are solved. He's that powerful. If I can just touch the hem of his garment, I'll be healed. It's the same thing we've seen in other passages. And verse 10 says they're pressing around him in order to touch him. Thousands of people eagerly pressing forward, wanting to get close to Jesus. Jesus' selection of his leadership took place in the context of this intensive popularity. There were people who wanted to be with him. All kinds of people. His selection also took place in the context of intense hatred. In the passage that we finished last time, the preceding passage, the Pharisees were so incensed at Jesus because of his proclamation of truth and his demonstration of power that they have decided to kill him. The people are excited about Jesus, but the leadership are ready to murder him any way they can with anything it takes, including teaming up with their archenemies, the Herodians. So, it's not a real safe time to be in the inner circle. There's a contract out on this man's life already at this point. So there's great popularity and there's great hatred. The whole nation is polarized over the question of who Jesus is. Even so, people are eagerly seeking more involvement with Jesus. And at the same time, the hatred just keeps brewing and the leaders are making that involvement more dangerous every day. It's in this context that Jesus makes his choices. Now, you might expect some things based on that context. I mean, it's a dangerous time to be in the inner circle. It's a dangerous time to be affiliated with him. Murder is in the air. So you might expect that because of the danger, Jesus would have a volunteer army. Now, it's noble, isn't it? We're going to war. Let's just take volunteers. Let's see who's interested. Let's put the word out. We've got some positions here. Let's see who wants them. But he did something very different from that, which is intensified for us because of the context that God presents it to us in. Jesus chose who these leaders would be. You might think that with so many people asking for more involvement, that Jesus would be accepting resumes, that he might do a little interviewing, that he might allow at least some competition for the positions, or like so many churches want to do, just make a spot for everybody. I mean, why can't you have 4,000 leaders? I mean, come on. Just make a spot. They want to be here. Come on. But Jesus chose. He chose. Now, in this crowd of thousands and thousands of people from all over the region, there would have been every imaginable kind of person. There were wealthy people in this crowd who were very successful, who had demonstrated some significant leadership already in their lives. There would have been people who were already leaders in the synagogue and had already led in a religious environment. There would have been people who had some influence and some pull in politics. Out of all of these thousands of people, somebody maybe who could build a bridge and begin a healthy dialogue with the Pharisees. You got them. I mean, they got to be in that crowd. That's too many people not to have some. There were people who were smart. There were people who were devoted to the things of God already. There were people who were polished, energetic, charismatic in their personalities. Every conceivable kind of person. You just don't get thousands and thousands of people together and not have some of the best. And Jesus chose. Would have been no problem to get volunteers. Would have been no problem to let people sort of compete for it. But Jesus didn't do that. He chose. He chose 12. He did it without looking at resumes. He did it without asking them what they were interested in doing. He chose. Now, this fact is also intensified as we read the rest of the Gospels and realize the people that Jesus chose are not the people you would have picked. The names are here in this passage, but the personalities come out as the story goes along. And as the personalities come out, you realize these people don't fit the template for leadership, do they? This is a motley crew. These are not the people that you would expect to lead anything. They tended to be very selfish. Not a good quality for a leader. They were petty with one another. They're always arguing about who's the best and always putting each other down in the process. Some of them were doing an end run, even getting their mom involved and trying to get them the key position. You know, let's get a diversion over here, bro, and we'll send mom around on the left and she can sneak up behind and make the request for us. Underhanded, backbiting, petty people. Weren't they? I mean, come on. Tended to be kind of selfish. They didn't really have that drive for ministry that you think a leader ought to have. You remember the time when they said, Jesus, come on. Send the crowds away, man. Send them away and let them get something to eat, which being translated means we're hungry. Can we stop ministering now? Or the time when somebody disagreed and they come to Jesus for permission to call down fire from heaven on these dear souls. They're not team players. They don't have the stick-to-itiveness. They're constantly at odds with each other. They're arguing about who's the best and trying to put the others out of the running. They don't have an ability to build consensus or work together or inspire a lot of loyalty in others, except for one of them. There's one guy in the 12 who's got it all. He's ambitious. He's aggressive. He doesn't ever seem to be in the who's the best argument when it comes up. The only one who had the kind of ambition that would put him in the textbook leadership position was Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Jesus chose. And he didn't pick who you might expect him to pick. He didn't use the method that you might expect him to use. Didn't interview, receive resumes, ask for volunteers, or make a spot for everybody. And he did not otherwise put this choice into human hands. He selected men who did not know left from right and said, you're it, and I'll make you what you need to be. The text says he chose based on his preferences. Verse 13. Notice who is central in the doing here. He went up on the mountain and he summoned those whom he himself wanted, and they came to him. He summoned those whom he himself wanted. This is the divine prerogative that most people forget about and some deny outright. Jesus chooses. He chose based on his preferences. And since he knows his purposes, he knew who to choose. Now, even within this group of 12, there are men who were more prominent than other men. There were the leaders among the leaders, weren't there? And then there was one leader among them all out of these 12. Beyond these 12, Luke 10 tells us that there were others. There was a time when Jesus appointed 70 and sent them out two by two. But he does all this by his preference. We need to keep in mind as we think about these next two points that God is sovereign and whom he chooses for leadership. He decides. Jesus does still make that same kind of choice. He does not personally call us up on a mountain and say, "All right, you're in." But he still chooses. It's his church. Leaders in his church are his leaders. It's God himself who determines what gifts to give, as we talked about this morning and last week in the Sunday school hour. He sets people apart. He uniquely qualifies them. And we're just like Peter. We don't deserve it. In fact, we're pretty pathetic, but God makes us what we need to be if he sets us apart. Now, this choosing is important as we think about the rest of this. The second reminder about church leadership is this. Jesus summons church leadership. He doesn't just choose, he summons whom he chooses. Verse 13, again, it says, "He went up on the mountain and summoned those whom he wanted, and they came to him." He calls, and they come. Now, there's an aspect of obedience in that verse. You know, if Jesus calls, you ought to go. You ought to be ready and willing and do that. And if we resist that, that's an issue to think through and to repent of and follow where he leads. There's an aspect of that. We may for a time resist, and we ought to obey and be reminded that it's sin to resist when Jesus calls, but there's something more here. The statement is a reminder of the effectual call of our Lord. It's kind of basic. You might just read right past it, but it says he summoned them and they came. That's how it works. You see, Jesus has to supply the faith necessary anyway. He has to supply the courage and the backbone and the desire to obey, and he does supply that. So when he calls a leader, he also supplies what is necessary for the obedience, and you come. Jesus puts in men the desire and the willingness to lead within his church. Some people think of that kind of leadership as a position of privilege and ease. Spend your life eating chicken and avoiding work. I can tell you that it's not that way. There are certainly blessings, privileges even. But there's little ease and a lot of hardships. The men in this passage have just identified themselves with the person who is on the hit list. They have enemies now by association. Vile, aggressive enemies just because they're now affiliated with Jesus. That's how it is. You step into leadership, you have enemies. Immediately, people who hate your Lord hate you. Now they know, oh, you're kind of at the top of the pile. I'm going to hate you the most. Still that way. What about the rest of this crowd? Thousands and thousands of fickle people. You know, where are they later? They're yelling, "Crucify, crucify." It's still that way. A lot of people are on again, off again, in and out. Yeah, I'm great. As long as I'm happy, it's great. And something changes, and now they're enemies too. Still that way. And yet Jesus puts something in the men that he calls that gives them the willingness to endure that. And a desire to serve in spite of those challenges. A willingness to take on added responsibility. A longing to be a blessing to others in his church in a particular way. To protect, to teach, to lead. He summons leaders to himself and they come. It still works that way. You can't not come. You can't stand it. I can tell you, I tried. It's like Jeremiah. When I try to keep quiet, it's like fire in my bones. I can't stand it. Still that way. Not a desire to hold an exalted position, but a work that God does in the heart of a man to call him to leadership in his church. And I'll tell you, without that spiritual calling, a man is not fit to serve. In leadership, whatever other qualities he's got, it won't be enough. Some people mistake a desire for prominence for a calling to ministry, to leadership within a church. Some people become frustrated in an environment where there's not a lot of godly leadership, and they think, well, I can do better than that. I at least love the Word. And they step in and try to fix things, and that doesn't usually go well either because they're not equipped. What a man needs is a summons from the Lord Himself, marching orders from the commander-in-chief. And if a man has that indispensable quality, that other stuff doesn't matter. And if he does have it, it'll be evident to the church. A lot of men say that they're called of God. It's kind of a hard thing, isn't it? How do you know? It's a little bit hard to argue the point. I mean, it's not like now they got a mark on their forehead or something, and you can go, let me check, pull your bangs up. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, you're called. How do you know that? Well, I'll tell you, this summons from the Lord, it ought to make a mark on your life. And if the mark's not there, wait. I was on the staff of a church in Texas years ago when I was in seminary. And there was a man in that church who could not get along with anyone. And he finally left the church in a huff with pretty much everybody mad at him. All 850 of us. I had just shown up, hadn't been there long, didn't know him well, but I knew he was making trouble in the church. He was very brash and, you know, it's my way or all 800 are wrong and I'm right and just not living well, whatever his point was when he left. And then he decides that he's called to the pastorate and he's going to go off to seminary. I mean, 2 months hadn't gone by after he left in a huff. He's joined some other church. And he says he's called to ministry and he wants to go to seminary. And the seminary wanted a recommendation from a church in which he had been actively serving for at least a year. Well, he couldn't get that where he was because he hadn't even been there 2 months yet. And so he wrote back to us for the recommendation. Now, this is one of those churches that voted on everything. And so it came before the meeting and it was presented as this guy that we all know is now called to preach and wants us to give a church recommendation to the seminary that he wants to go to. And so, you know, it's kind of like everybody's like, well, what do we do with that? And somebody speaks up and says, well, you know, if he's called to preach, then, well, we just shouldn't question that. I mean, you know, maybe God's doing a work in his life and turning him around, and that sure would be good. And I think that's a good thing. And everybody seemed to be thinking that was great. And it's about to go to the vote, and they're going to approve it almost unanimously. Just before the, okay, all in favor, somebody said, well, no, wait. If God's called him to preach, shouldn't we be able to tell some way by his life? I mean, the person said, I hope that this is true and that he really is changing, but if he is, a year is not too long for him to prove that to the church that he's serving in now. And everybody went, yeah. So we had our vote, and it was almost unanimous against doing anything, and we denied the recommendation. And I think we probably saved the church from a wolf for at least a year. Now, if God had done a work in his life, that's fine. He doesn't need to be a novice anyway. The year's good for him. Grow in godliness and then go there, because seminary's not easy. But either way, if you can't see it in their lives, wait. Just wait. Let God prove it first. If he summoned that man, you can tell. And until you can tell, leave him out of leadership. Jesus calls to church leadership. Jesus summons to church leadership. The third reminder about it is Jesus appoints church leadership. And that's not the same thing. Verse 14, it says he appointed 12 so that they would be with him and that he could send them out to preach and to have authority to cast out the demons. Jesus appointed these men distinctly. This is distinct from calling them. He determined who they would be. He determined which 12 would be in the group. He called them. They came. But this is beyond that. He appointed them to tasks in leadership. And that carries with it some inherent authority. It's like, who says you can? Well, Jesus did. He not only called me, but he told me what to do. He appointed me. These men had a valid role, not because they took it, not because they said, all right, the rest of you don't know anything, I'm the one with the answer, let me step in here and fix this, but because God himself gave it to them. Not just a general calling, but a specific appointment to do something. They have authority because Jesus has now bestowed it on them with this appointment. He's given them what they need to be qualified. He's deemed them to be qualified. He's appointed them to the task, and then they can go and do it. They have validity because of his work, not because of what they can do. They have it by his bestowal of the right to do the job. Now, like the other aspects of leadership, this final step comes from the Lord himself. He gives what is needed to be legitimate. It's his stamp on their lives that allows them to function. Now here Jesus appoints these men to two specific tasks. Verse 14 says that they might be with him. And that's always the first appointment for any and every Christian. It's so that you can be with him. You're called to be with him, walk with him, seek him first. Now, this is particularly necessary for leadership. These guys had to spend a lot of time with Jesus or they're never going to make it. And so they spent all their time together and along the way he taught them. Only then could they have the things they needed to make it and function as they should. Only by significant time spent with Jesus. Now this is how it is for any Christian, but especially for any church leader. You've got to spend time in the Word and prayer. You've got to be diligent and seeking Jesus himself. That's the first calling. And then this text also says that they were appointed that he might send them out. There's an appointment to specific service. In the case of these disciples, it was to preach and even to have authority over demonic powers. But in every case, it is a calling to service it in some specific area. Well, it's no different today. Ultimately, it's our God who determines the places of service that each of us has in his church. This is why we're spending so much time on the gifts in the 9:30 hour. We're going to take a month of thinking about that at least. God determines what we do by how he equips us to do things. And when his leadership serves him effectively, his appointment of them is evident to everybody. Ideally, when we appoint leaders in a church, we're only going to appoint men whom God has just obviously chosen. Men that God has clearly summoned to himself. We're not deciding who should lead. We're verifying what God has made obvious in somebody's life. Now, some of you young men have expressed this kind of calling on your life. A couple in this room right now. And I can say that we delight in what we can see in you that proves your claim. It's a lot of preparation from here. You keep living for the Lord. You keep growing in godliness. And there'll come a time when the people who love the Lord will not be able to stand to keep you out of a leadership position. It'll be so plain in your life. You just keep doing it. And the day that God appoints you to a specific leadership position, people will know it. The calling's to him first, and then to some specific appointment. Live well for him and prepare for that day. Some of you may have that kind of calling and have not expressed it to me personally yet. The same goes for you. If God's in it, it will be obvious to everybody. Just live for the Lord. Do what he's called you to do in every way that you have opportunity. Some of you know that you're not called to church leadership, but to some other form of service in God's church. You still have a responsibility in this category, though. Do not quietly sit by and allow the appointment of someone you know not to be appointed by God. If someone's put forth as a potential church leader and you know that person is not qualified, is not ready, you've got to warn that person and you've got to warn the leadership. Stop. Wait. You have an obligation to affirm the Lord's choices, but only those. That's for the whole church. And he's able to make his choices clear. There's no harm in waiting if it's not clear. And what if you want to lead in the church and people don't see it yet? Take some time and prove it. If God's in it, they'll see it. Serve somebody. Be a blessing to people until everyone is convinced of what you think is true. And if it's not of God, those people who just can't see it will save you from a more intensive judgment, from a stricter judgment, from a presumptuous ministry. If the church of the living God can't see it, you're not ready. Every person is obligated to hold the rest of the church accountable to the standards of leadership laid out in the Scripture. And if you're not called to leadership, or if you're preparing for leadership, or if you don't even know yet, if you're a believer, you've got a responsibility in this to hold the rest of God's church to God's standard of leadership. You can support those who are obviously appointed. You can pray for them. You can do everything to help them and make it easier and more effective. Such support honors the Lord and it helps His church. Now, we have in our midst just such a man. By the clear marks of his life, we believe that the Lord has called this man to himself, chosen him, and summoned him to leadership. You know, of course, I'm talking about Tim Ake, if you're in our congregation. God has obviously done a work in this man's life. We saw it long ago. I thought within the first 6 weeks and meeting in their home well over a year ago that I was going to have a mutiny if I didn't make him an elder. It's that obvious. People are coming to me, you've got to consider Tim Ake. I hope you're going to make Tim Ake an elder. Have you thought about Tim Ake yet? Well, Tim and I have been working for more than a year, completing an intensive course of preparation, as much because I had to learn how to do it as to make sure Tim was on the same page. Over this time, Tim's taken more and more responsibility, and as he has, he's continued to demonstrate all of these marks on his life. And I tell you, I know of no reason that we shouldn't make Tim Ake an elder in our church. He's a good example of what I'm talking about. It's obvious, and that's how it ought to be. So, after a long, long time of waiting, we're going to make this appointment official on July the 10th, which was the first day Tim and I could make that happen. Hope you can come. Bring somebody with you. July the 10th, during the 11 o'clock service. All we're going to do is recognize what God has done in this man's life. And I want to call you to prayer for Tim, because he's going to step it up a notch. There's going to be some new enemies. There's going to be some new hardships when the fickle crowds are fickle. Pray for his family. It's going to be different. In terms of what he's going to be doing, it's not going to be a lot different, but once it's official, there's a whole new standard. More spiritual warfare. I want you to remember him in prayer. And I want you to remember that Tim's service to this church is God's choice that we're affirming. That's why we took so long and we've been so careful. This is not something to be presumed. This is not something a man takes on himself. It's God's choice. And we're just going to affirm what God has made obvious. So, I warned Tim last night that he was going to be the conclusion of this sermon. I've been looking forward to that text just so we could talk some about this. Pray for him. And your responsibility to him is to do that. And to us, from here forward, we got to live this standard of leadership. And the next elder, and any other key position of leadership in this church, has to meet those same standards. If God hasn't made it apparent, and we start to do it, your job is to say, you better wait. God chooses his leaders. He summons them to himself, equipping them for what they need to do, and they come. And God appoints them. And if there's not a mark on their lives, the church has to wait. I just want to challenge you to think on those things. We've got men in our midst who are called and who have proven it with the way they live. We've got other men who are struggling with this issue of a calling to ministry. Pray for these guys. Pray for us. Let me lead us right now.